resist our persistence as our history's real. A song will can shine like gold.
Welcome to the Wayne Bennett Podcast, celebrating West Virginia people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now here's your host, Wayne Bennett.
Welcome to Wayne Bennett's podcast. My name is Wayne Bennett. This is episode 76, and we'd like to give a shout out to Matt Mullins and the Bring Downs for doing our intro music. And if you ever get a chance to see those guys, they're something else. Very entertaining. Our guest today is a family friend and entrepreneur and an extraordinary photographer, Mr. Chris Hancock. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
We had people on here before that talked about growing up in the YMCA. You literally grew up in the YMCA with your dad, Mel, being the assistant director. Do you remember when you first started going to the Y and how you got started?
Probably my going to the Y at the earliest age started about my parents not getting along very well. And my dad and I lived in a closet upstairs in the Memorial Building. And during that time, the Y was my personal playground and daycare. And I got to sit on the felt of a pool table and play pool with my hands. And I got to back a trampoline up to the basketball goal and dunk when I was 5 years old.
Wow. What were some of the other things that when we moved down to the new Y, what were some of the things you participated in? I know you were in daycare and I know you were in wrestling.
I did everything that I could possibly do in that building, including first thing was I got very lost because it was huge compared to any other place I had been. But I did wrestling. I did gymnastics at the Y, table tennis. And I wanted to do all the things the adults could do, even at a young age, including play racquetball and get in the sauna and get in the hot tub. And because my dad was there, I got a little bit of special privilege.
Kind of a perk, wasn't it, I guess. Yeah. Now, you continued wrestling, and you wrestled some in high school, didn't you?
Correct, until somebody handed me a camera.
And did you play any other sports besides wrestling?
In high school, I played varsity baseball.
Okay.
And I gave up after junior high. I gave up track, but I pole vaulted in junior high. And that's probably the extent of it. And then once I got a camera, I began to photograph sports. And that photographing sports became
my
focus.
In high school?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did they have a club or anything, or did you just on their own?
It was for the newspaper and the yearbook staff, so you could actually have a high school sponsored class that you got a grade in for participating and being a part of the Eagle Dispatch newspaper.
Yeah. Now, back then, did you have to develop the film and stuff yourself?
Yes, I just had my 35th class reunion, and while they opened the school for us, the first place I went was to my old dark room, which was beside the attendance office in Woodrow Wilson High School. And I had the luxury of, when I was a senior, I think I had 5 classes that were devoted to journalism, and I spent a good portion of my day in that dark room developing black and white film and making black and white prints for both the yearbook and the newspaper.
What's there now?
It's a janitor's office.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned wrestling at the Y. You know, Mel is the one that came up with the idea that we should start wrestling, and I was assistant wrestling coach at Woodrow Wilson at the time, and he called me one summer, and I was actually building a room on my mother's house, and I don't know how I even got her phone number, but we didn't have cell phones back then, and he asked me if I was interested, and I said, well, I'm still coaching. I said, well, we'll we'll do something. So we had a couple of clinics, and then we had a tournament. And, you know, I wasn't working at the Y. I was just volunteering at that time. But that's kind of how things get started. But I remember, one, when we were getting into it pretty big time, and I was working at the Y, we took a Christmas trip down to Big Creek High School. And you were with us. We took a van, and then there were several parents that went. And it was over Christmas vacation. My friend Fred Strom was a coach down there, and he was trying to make a little money having a youth tournament. And you were out on the mat wrestling, and Mel was with us. And the particular guy you were wrestling, a pretty strong fella and everything, you were trying to stand up, and he kept tight-waisting you. And your dad was going, "Stand up, stand up, stand up." And all of a sudden you go, "I'm trying, Dad."
Actually, it was Dwayne Durham that was wrestling.
Is that who it was?
And Dwayne Durham grew up to be twice the size of me. And he was twice the size of me then at the same age. And actually, Dwayne Durham was pinning me for three periods. And my dad was yelling, "Bridge."
Oh, is that what it was?
And after hearing him do it for about a minute and a half, I just yelled back at him and said, "I'm trying." And and then when I didn't get pinned, he was really proud of me. But
the place got real quiet though when I
yelled out loud, I bet.
But I'll never forget that. It was
me
funny.
Either.
You had two sisters, Elisa and Elizabeth. And what did you do? What happened after high school? What did you when you graduated? You graduated in 87?
Yes, sir. Okay. And I went to Marshall after that, and because my dad wouldn't pay for me to go anywhere else because he's a devoted Marshall fan. And my little sister, Aunt Elizabeth, also went to Marshall. So, you know, everybody that my dad was connected to went to Marshall. But I went to Marshall, and I also studied journalism, and I continued working for the university newspaper and yearbook staff. When I started school, I had two jobs, you know, the first year I started school, and I really enjoyed it. I got to photograph Marshall football and every other sport. I actually photographed the perfect season, national championship with Randy Moss, and got to do a great number of things there in Huntington. I don't blame Marshall, but I wasn't a big fan of Huntington. And it's just a kind of a rough town compared to growing up in Beckley. Huntington was a little rougher around the edges than I was used to. But staying busy, like everybody tells you, idle hands, staying busy kept me out of all that trouble.
Did you get to travel with the team and stuff?
Sometimes. Uh-huh. I went to the thing I'm telling you about, this part of me growing up, was that when I went to Marshall, I did stay busy and I worked all these other jobs. I had a friend that I went to school with who was a national merit finalist, which meant he could have gone to Harvard, but somehow he went to Huntington and got sucked into like after hours clubs and gambling. And even though he was a genius, he didn't really graduate from Marshall. And I was very good at school and very good at scheduling and all that sort of stuff, but I had set it up so my actual last semester in school, I was only going to have to take one class, a 4-credit-hour class, and I packed up to come home, and I went to see this band in a club, and when I came back, somebody had broken into my car and taken all my books and my camera and my clothes and my dad's Boy Scout backpack from the 50s that I had in there. They took all the change out of my car, and I drove home sort of feeling defeated, and I got a job, and I did not go back to school at that time. I recently just finished and got my degree from Marshall during the pandemic.
Wow.
So finally put that to bed, and wish I could have done it while my dad was alive so he could have been proud and given me a big hug, but
did you get a degree in journalism?
I have a Board of Regents degree, which is one of the things that they do for people that have life experience.
Yeah.
And mostly my work as a real estate agent is what gave me the credit hours to go on and graduate.
Now, when you came back to Beckley, did you start to work for Beckley newspapers?
I came back to Beckley, there was not a job available doing what I wanted to do for Beckley newspapers. So I worked for Camelot Music in the mall, a record store, and really enjoyed working in a record store. I would love to open a record store in Beckley right now. We have no record store in Beckley.
Yeah. How come you didn't stay with Camelot and get into the...
The corporate thing?
Yeah.
I didn't like the mall. Even when I was a kid, I really wasn't a big fan of the mall. Uh-huh. I'd go there to meet a girl and then try to leave as fast as possible.
So when did you first get hooked up with Beckley newspapers or taking pictures?
As soon as there was a job available, they called me because I worked at Beckley newspapers part-time between the time I was 16 until 1997. Uh-huh. And maybe only a few of those years I worked full-time. Not to be disparaging, but they did the same thing most other businesses do, which is they take advantage and work you less than full-time and don't offer you benefits and don't offer you insurance.
Sure.
And they got away with doing that because I was a kid and, you know, didn't demand more. I was just, and I enjoyed the job, so I didn't really complain very much.
Yeah. Now, you got into taking pictures. Were you basically on call when they needed somebody? They would call you. But you won numerous awards, state awards, or among newspapers and those kind of things. And I know you had a photography show one time at Serendipity Coffee House. I remember that. And then some of those things that... in Beckley, you did a print of downtown Beckley one time, and then during one of the big snowstorms that we had, I think it was 98 or somewhere along the line, man, you going around taking the pictures of all the places that had collapsed and,
right.
and those kind of things. And so, I mean, you were there.
Right.
And, but in 1995, I think, you were in Pittsburgh and the Grateful Dead was up there. Jerry Garcia that much. And you got a picture of him that brought you a lot of notoriety. How did that happen?
Well, I started photographing the Grateful Dead in 1992. And then it was just, it became a way to get away and do things in the summer. I did the summer tour mostly and kind of regionally. I never really went to the West Coast or anything like that to do shows. But I contacted the publicist for the Grateful Dead, and he allowed me to have credentials to shoot and bring my equipment in. I did a good job, and I shared some images with them. I also shared images with the Associated Press, which allowed those images to circulate around the world. And of modern images, non-60s related images, probably one of the most published pictures of him ever. I didn't make a ton of money, but I certainly did have a lot of fun. And sometimes, you know, if you have fun, you're left with that. You might make money, but you're never left with the money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that one particular picture, I guess it was him in a purple shirt. It was on magazines. It was on T-shirts, different types of paintings. And, of course, very few of them were authorized. And a quote from you, somebody asked you about that. And you said you didn't think it would be Jerry-like to lawyer up and demand money, you know, in which you might have could have got some. But it would have been... long-driven court battle, probably.
The example of the Grateful Dead is that if you do your job and you share your work with everyone, you gain fame and notoriety and accolades. The Grateful Dead allowed people to tape their live shows for free and trade them over and over. They didn't make any effort to monetize that. So that's where that sort of credo comes from, that you do what you do. If you like the music, you do it to support the music.
Now, have cameras changed that much from the time you started in high school to now? I mean...
More than they ever have in the history of cameras.
How do you stay up on that? Do you train?
Indirectly, a camera is like a paintbrush. There's a bunch of different paintbrushes, but they all paint the wall. And so, if you have an understanding of how to paint, then you can pick up any paintbrush and be proficient. And the thing about photography is more understanding light and motion, and then just whichever camera you pick up, you can make you know, a proficient image. It's almost like a mechanic knows his tools. You know what I'm trying to say? Uh-huh. And tools have changed a lot as well, but you still are accomplishing the same end. And for me, one of the things that I think is unique about photography is that you develop a style which is individual to yourself. And then what you do is you just use this tool to convey your stylistic thoughts. You know, you're painting with light, basically. So, but the idea, as I would be honest, you asked a real good question. I started taking pictures because I liked being alone in a dark room for many hours every day and not having an immense amount of supervision and then having a creative end. Then everything became digital and photographers' dark rooms closed and they got moved into a cubicle right out in the newsroom with everybody else, and there was no privacy, and there was no chemicals, there was no paper. The thing that's changed the most about photography probably is not that necessarily the cameras, it's the fact that nobody prints a picture anymore. There's never a print of anything.
Yeah.
And these things, people don't realize these files, because they're not tangible, you can't hold the file in your hand, they degrade over time, just like anything else would. If you see an old book, its pages turned yellow or tattered, and the same thing happens to these digital files.
And that's one of the, it kind of alludes to one of the reasons why we do podcasts. You know, the newspaper business is dying, and people in the past, when they researched, they would go back and look at old newspapers and stuff, and it's not there. It's not going to be there for the future, I don't think, you know, unless something changes. Everything is digital. And we thought that this podcast might just be another way of recording history of certain people. And I know that another quote from you was, your pictures document your own fabulous experiences, you know, so you kind of tell where you've been and what you've seen and those kind of things. That's pretty neat. What kind of, you spoke of the Grateful Dead. What kind of music do you like? I know.
I am so open to music in general. I can listen to bluegrass, gospel, modern outlaw country, the Grateful Dead, jazz. I have a huge record collection. I love records. Right after my dad passed away, I went out in the garage and found this turntable that he'd given me when I was 13 that had a broken belt, and I ordered a belt from eBay for $1 and put this turntable back together and just started spinning and buying records again instantly. I probably have a way bigger music collection now than I ever had in my life. And, you know, music is a thing that not only do you get the joy of hearing someone perform and the visual stimulation of seeing them enjoy it, you're out there in the crowd among these fans when you're making these images, and you get to meet these people and hear their stories. And it's just, it's probably the most full experience I could imagine having in life is being at a concert. You see old people, you see little tiny babies with headphones on to protect their ears that people are bringing them to their first concert that they'll never even remember. But, you know, music is a thing that it just, it's like following a piper to a certain extent. They talk about how a piper led the rats or the snakes out of a town. It's like when the Grateful Dead ended in 1995, effectively for me, I started to think, what was I going to do with my summer? And then I came home and I saw Tony Rice play Shadows by Gordon Lightfoot on PBS at this bluegrass festival in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. The first thing I did was look up how far Wilkesboro, North Carolina was. And then I've been going to Wilkesboro, North Carolina every April for the last 20 plus years and seeing the most epic East Coast bluegrass festival you could imagine. I've seen everybody at this event from Lyle Lovett to Linda Ronstadt to John Prine to Doc Watson, Alison Krauss, just Bella Fleck, the stars of bluegrass music. Wow. Bluegrass music's interesting too because it's the people don't act like rock stars. Like you can walk right up to the bluegrass person will be walking around the show listening to the other performers. People will hand them their baby.
Yeah.
You know, they talk to people. They're not quite so standoffish as a rock star is, which is something that really drew me in. And I've become a bluegrass disciple after that. I really spend most of my time listening to bluegrass music.
Wow. Now, and you got to share this story. This, I guess it was around 96, you had an opportunity to go to Woodstock, the second Woodstock. You, of course, won the first Woodstock. You were, I guess, just been born
right
around the time. But the second one was in the same place. And tell us about that. How did that trip evolve?
Well, there's a fella who's passed away now, a local infamous legendary character named John Carl Baldwin. And John Carl Baldwin was my friend. And he was telling me that he was going to go to Woodstock with the Gesundheit Institute and Patch Adams. And this movie had just come out about Patch Adams, so he had become this character that everybody knew about internationally, whereas he was up a holler, you know, most of the time and not getting that kind of recognition. But when Robin Williams played him in a movie, he became a star, and he was going to charter a bus and take people from his organization to Woodstock to work a concession stand to raise money for the Gesundheit. So we jumped on a bus. We had to drive to D.C., jump on a bus, and then we were taken to the site and dropped off.
Now, did he ride with you?
He did. Yeah, he was okay on the bus with us, and we watched a performance, a DVD, or it might have been a VHS tape of the first Woodstock. We watched that the entire time we traveled. We got there, it poured the rain a majority of the time. It was kind of a miserable camping experience. I did not take a tent. I slept in the rain in a sleeping bag with my gear inside the sleeping bag with me in a plastic bag. But I got to see what I wanted to see and photograph what I wanted to see. I got to photograph Crosby, Stills, and Nash that weekend, which was pretty special.
I like that.
And mostly for me, that event was just about all the people and the place as much as it was about the artists that performed. I remember photographing and putting my emphasis on photographing Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but I also had volunteered to work in this concession stand, so there were times that people like Joe Cocker were playing that I was selling people chicken sandwiches, you know, instead of working.
I think in the first Woodstock, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young played about 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was so behind and a little unorganized. They weren't ready for that many people, but now Patch Adams had actually built a clinic in Pocahontas County,
right,
in Gesundheit, and it was set up to be like a free clinic, and that was his whole theory, and he was always trying to raise money so they could provide the free health care. And he's still around. He's based in Urbana, Illinois, I think, now. And they still, he and a group of doctors, they'll travel to Africa and places and still do. If you haven't seen the movie, it's you got to see it, you know. And I think at first when it first came out, he didn't like the movie. And criticized it heavily, but then after a while, he kind of started coming around because he at first was critical of Robin Williams. Said Robin Williams made $21 million, and we're trying to raise money for the clinic. But found out later that Robin Williams was donating quite a sum of money to St. Jude's and places like that. So I think they got back in sync there. But he is quite a character and still kicking. Some of the pictures that you took at Woodstock too, did they make it to any newspapers or anything like that? Or
I brought them home and I shared them with my local paper, and they published a spread of things that I did at Woodstock. But while I was at Woodstock, the infrastructure really wasn't there for me to share with the world. There wasn't any transmission facilities or anything like that where I could send pictures.
Yeah.
I didn't have access to anything like that. And at the time, that was still the days of shooting film. You know, it wasn't a digital time. So there would have had to have been a place to process film, you know, and then a place to scan, and then a way to transmit. And none of those things were available. But I have this habit of believing that even though I've had good luck in sharing pictures and selling pictures to wire services, that I do this for me. And that if I have the stuff and it pleases me and I like it, that's all that matters. I will probably be potentially more posthumously famous than when I'm alive, potentially, when somebody has to go through all this stuff and they see the volume of work that I've done.
But you've got to eat, and so you got into real estate for a while, selling. You still...
I'm involved. I don't have an active license selling real estate right now. And I think one of the reasons that I did get a license was the same reason that I studied anything, was because I wanted to be able to represent myself in my own transactions with some confidence and authority. And that didn't hurt my feelings that I could help other people buy and sell. In fact, I thought I was a really excellent buyer's agent, because I felt like every time I was doing that, I was making somebody's dreams come true.
Yeah.
As a listing agent, which is the bread and butter of the business, I really didn't feel as confident. I felt like a lot of times somebody just wanted to be rid of something that they didn't want anymore. And that was a hard thing for me to wrap my head around, just the concept of it. I wanted to be involved in making somebody's dreams come true as opposed to just helping you settle your estate.
Yeah. Well, I'd been in the real estate business for a few years, and when I first got in there, I thought, you know, I want to get the find the good deals, you know, and this and that. Well, once the bankers and the brokers and those guys got through with it, there weren't that many great deals around unless you just stumbled on something.
Yeah.
At least that's what I found. But Chris Farley was talking about living in a van down by the river. Well, you actually have a nice cozy house down by the river. How did that come on New River too?
Well, that could bring this conversation all the way around back to the YMCA in a weird way. So many people came through the YMCA that were a big part of touching my life. And also there was this impetus that even when I wasn't in the YMCA, that all these people involved in it were out here watching me in this community, making sure that I grew up properly and didn't go off the deep end. Well, when I, let's see, it's been 5 years ago, I went to a party at my friend who's since passed away from Lou Gehrig's disease, Mike Richmond. I went to a party at Mike Richmond's house, and in the door walked Frank Hartenstein and his lovely wife, Patty. So I knew Frank when I was 5 years old. Frank Hartenstein was the biggest, toughest son of a bitch I'd ever laid eyes on. And my father had a glove in his office where Frank had knocked somebody's mouth guard out and then punched him again so quickly after their mouthpiece flew out that the guy's teeth cut a hole in his glove. Wow. And Dad had that in his office forever. Frank was a Golden Gloves champ, heavyweight champ. He was a Raleigh County Tough Man champ. And he strolled into this party, and my father, bless his heart, had taken me to the river and said, Frank Hartenstein lives right here, and Bob Douglas lives right here. And these people lived 100 yards from each other, two people that were special to my dad and special to me. And I told Frank that I was looking for a place. And without hesitation, he said, well, my neighbor came over and said he wants to sell his place, and he offered it to me, and I didn't want it. So would you be interested? And I said, well, let me have his phone number. So I called this guy, and 30 days later, I was sitting in a lawyer's office, signing the papers to buy this house. It was a very complicated transaction in the sense that it was an estate, and the fellow wasn't quite confident of what he owned and what he didn't own. And he was representing this property and saying, this is what I'm selling, but then using my experience, like I said, in real estate to protect myself, I went back to the GIS and I found out that he didn't own three of the lots and one of the buildings he was trying to sell.
Oh.
So one of those buildings had the well in it. So I pretty much told him, even though I was wanted to buy it, I said, listen, I'm okay with your price, but I want you to be aware that you don't own this stuff right here. So I've got to go seek out these people and buy this property from them before I can buy your property. So give me a week. And in that week, I went to South Charleston and I bought the driveway from this fella that went to the property. He owned the driveway. He said that he bought it from his friend who was getting a divorce for $750 in 1975. And so I offered him money that I thought would do that, plus paid his taxes for however long. And then there were two ladies in Bradley that owned the garage. They said that their grandfather won this land in a poker game and that they were there twice when they were 7 and 9 years old and had never been back. They didn't want to sell, so I said, okay, keep my name and phone number. Since I had bought the driveway, I had bought the well that served both the houses I was buying, so I went ahead with the purchase of the houses. And then a year later, the ladies that owned the other part of the property called me and said they were interested in selling. But they wanted almost as much as I paid for all the property when I first met them. So luckily I had my ducks in order there and I produced a deed for the property that was adjacent to theirs that I had just bought. And I said, well, I bought this for $2,500. You have two of these lots. What would you consider selling them to me for? Well, they were wanted $20,000 to start with. And when I showed them the deed for $2,500, they came out and offered to sell it for $5,000.
That's good.
So but it was a very complicated purchase, but it's one of the things that has kept me active and busy in, you know, as I've grown older. I've been working on remodeling it. I've bought a raft and I row an oar frame raft now for exercise and really enjoy that, being out on the water. It's brought me very close and I have a very good relationship with, I love birds. I wish I could find the words to tell you how important birds are to me at this point in my life, where I never really paid attention to them at all before. But now I am trying to be better at audio location, where I hear a bird call and I try to locate the bird visually, and I've learned the bird calls to where when I'm sitting around town now, I hear a bird, I know exactly what bird that is.
You take pictures of them?
I take pictures of the birds. In fact, the bird that I've fallen in love with the most is this bird that the Audubon book says is not supposed to be here. It's called a tree swallow. And a lot of people mistake tree swallows for purple martins because they're very similar. They're not seed-eating birds. They basically just fly and eat insects. And they're very active, and they almost look like a mini jet fighter plane when they're out there. They have this ability to fly and smack the water. Like, if I hit the water that hard with my face, I'd be knocked out. But somehow they hit the water, pick up a bug, and keep flying. I want to have an entire series about the lives of these birds where I photograph their young, I photograph their mating, I photograph their eating of bugs and that sort of stuff, and their flight patterns. And I'm going to give myself all the time I need to do it because I just love doing it.
Yeah.
I've gotten to where I see bald eagles in the gorge on a regular basis. I sort of keep a journal.
I think I saw a bald eagle the other day at when I was crossing the bridge. And I slowed down, and my mom told Diane about it. I said, I'm almost positive it was. And
what time was it? What time
was
that?
It would have been in the morning. It would, but I know their presence is more now than ever before.
Yep.
I mean, they're starting to nest more around New River area. And I know in 2015, your dad passed away.
Correct.
And I had worked with him at the Y for several years. And of course, he was there when I came and helped me get a job, actually, and was there when I left. And actually was unexpectedly when he passed away, which was quite a shock to everyone. But and I went to the memorial service. I did not go to the Spirit of Beckley Award that they had a few months later, and they recognized and honored Mel. But you got to talk.
You saw the best speech.
I don't mean got to talk.
If you went to the memorial at the church, you saw the best public speaking I ever did in my life. Somehow, I didn't plan any of it. I walked up there. I looked out into that audience. I saw people I knew and I'd lived with, and I saw all the collected love in the room from my dad. And it just, the words came to me very easily. I even, you know, the first thing I did when I got up there was told people I didn't need to be introduced because I was Mel Hancock's son and everybody knew that. And so I said, if you know me at all, then you won't think this is a surprise either. And then I pulled out a camera phone out of my pocket and told everybody in the room to act like they liked me, and I took their picture. And so I did that. And then, frankly, I probably flubbed it up a little bit at the Spirit of Beckley when I reflect on it. But the important part was me standing up and letting all those people understand and know how much I love my dad and how special he was to the community and his family. You know, they're just, I'm still looking around this town every day. I don't think I can do it, but I don't see anybody putting on those big shoes that Mel Hancock had that raised money for every nonprofit cause. You know, he went from the YMCA to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes to the Women's Resource Center at the end of his life. He was working for them, raising money for the Women's Resource Center. So, yeah, I did get to do those things, and it's maybe one of the things that people in this town learn via that shocking experience is that you have to give the flowers to people while they're living. It doesn't do any good to line up after they're gone and tell everybody how much you miss them or how important they were. You've got to give people the flowers while they're living. Sure.
And the city did, even after the Spirit of Beckley, they named Mel Hancock Way. I mean,
that's a big deal.
Yeah. And he was good. He was good at what he did. And he was the best that I've ever seen. And he would approach people that I would have been afraid to even talk to.
It's a quotient of passion.
Yeah.
It's not so much about finesse as it is just about passion and belief that what you're raising money for is the only thing people should give their money to. That's how my dad approached it all.
Yeah.
And it was almost like he could describe it in a way that would make you ashamed if you didn't get your wallet out and help out the YMCA or help out the Women's Resource Center.
Well, I know when we were raising money to redo the football stadium beside Park Middle School, or junior high at that time, and we're moving the Van Meter name over to the Woodrow Wilson High School and renamed the stadium there at Park, Bob Pruitt Stadium. I hadn't even called Mel to ask him to help, and he called me. And he was dead set on helping, and I knew when he said, I'll be over, we'll get to work on it, I knew we were in then.
That's right.
And it went well. I mean, he worked tirelessly at it. And it had to have been tough as far as the speaking. And you weren't used to speaking in front of people.
Correct.
But I thought you did a good job.
Well, thank you.
What's next for Chris Hancock? What you got?
I'm probably going to sit down at the river and watch the water go by and row a little green boat up and down as much as humanly possible. I will continue to follow bluegrass music and photograph bluegrass musicians as much as I can. I don't know. If I knew what was next all the time, I probably wouldn't have had the same life. The only thing I really haven't done that I think about that everybody else does is get married and have a kid. And I don't know that that's necessarily in the cards for me, but...
Well, I wouldn't do it just because you haven't done it.
Correct. That's my point. It's not like on a list of...
It's not like getting a pet.
Yeah. And most people... The funny part is the general populace is still having lots of kids. So I do it the same, like I can imagine if my dad hadn't been blessed with having kids, he would have treated every child as his own. And that's what I try to do. If they'll let me pick them up and squeeze them, I pick them up and squeeze them. You know, if they want a part of what I'm doing, if they show interest in what I'm doing, then I share with them. And I'll do it for any child, just like my dad would.
Yeah. Well, Chris, it's been nice having you here, man. I'm glad you came. And
me too.
And I enjoyed talking to you. Of course, you know, you can stop by any time. You don't have to. We don't have to make a recording, but we right. can do another one if you want.
Well,
to.
You know, the thing about this day and every day that somebody brings up my dad's name, it's just, it lifts me up. And you think when you're dealing with somebody like Mel Hancock that you're always going to hear his name. And of course, like you said, there is a street sign with his name on it now, but it's gotten to be a rare occasion that somebody even associates me with my dad that didn't grow up at the Y. So every time I'm out in the world and somebody talks about Mel Hancock, it just makes my day.
Well, you know, you and Elisa, and sometimes I call her Alicia, but you and Elisa, we've known you for since you were 5, 6 years old, and you guys are special, and Bennett family is very proud to know you guys. And like I said, the door's always unlocked.
Thank you, buddy.
And I appreciate you coming by. Anybody else that would like to be on our program, you can email me at awbennett50@gmail.com, and we'd love to have you. And remember, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet. Until next time, God bless you.
You ran around, had your good time. We said you love me just the same. When the chips are down.